We are culminating the spring series with the appearance this evening of Mr. Harrison Salisbury. Through the courtesy of the Vancouver Sun newspaper, and particularly through the personal interest of its publisher, Mr. Stuart Keat, whose own involvement with UBC has been of long standing ever since his student days on this campus. It gives me great pleasure to ask Mr. Stuart Keat to introduce our distinguished speaker.
Maybe you don't.
Thank you, Mrs. Armstrong, ladies and gentlemen, and the entire staff of the Vancouver Sun. Welcome. It's a great pleasure to introduce our guest speaker, who comes to the Institute by way of our lectureship program, which was inaugurated 10 years ago with the purpose of bringing outstanding journalists to this campus to speak to students and to the public. The byline of Harrison E. Salisbury is known and respected around the world as an editor, roving reporter, foreign correspondent, and author. For many years, he represented the New York Times in Moscow. In New York City, he served that great newspaper as foreign news editor, assistant managing editor, and editor of the editorial page. In 1955, he won the Pulitzer Prize for International Correspondence. In 1957, and again 10 years later, he was awarded the highly prized George Polk Memorial Award for Foreign Correspondence. His other honors include the Sigma Delta Chi, Overseas Press Club, and Sidney Hillman Awards. Mr. Salisbury has found time, while roaming the world on assignment for the Times, to write about a dozen books, a number of which have achieved the status of bestsellers. Among the memorable volumes he has produced in recent years are The 900 Days, The Siege of Leningrad, and A Study of Modern China to Peking and Beyond. We are delighted that Mr. Salisbury found it possible to fly out from New York yesterday to address us tonight. And his topic will be A Roving Editor Reports. I have much pleasure in introducing Mr. Harrison Salisbury.
Thank you very much. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I had a choice before me in considering what I would talk about here this evening. I could talk about the situation of the world or the situation of the United States. I didn't think I could pack both of them into one talk of about an hour. And so perhaps arbitrarily I picked the United States because it seems to me that while the world is always troubled, the developments in the United States in recent years have perhaps been more spectacular, more confusing, and possibly more interesting to a country which lies along that restless frontier and sometimes wonders what's happening to the south of it. I myself, although I've spent a lifetime chasing around the world a great deal of the time behind the Iron Curtain and in the communist countries of the world, a long time in Russia, China, Southeast Asia, and all of the communist countries, as a matter of fact, with the single exception of Cuba, find that reporting on the United States today is probably more fascinating than the rest of the world. I don't think that's just a manifestation of what some people have suggested is a new isolationism in the United States. I think it's a growing fascination that I have and many Americans have about what we're doing to ourselves and what we're doing to our country. I've thought a good deal about this, as well as attempting to report on it and interpret it. And I have a feeling that we've been going through what amounts to something like a revolution in the United States, one that started fairly quietly about 20 years ago, is still in progress, and the end of which cannot yet be foreseen. Unlike most revolutions, it isn't recognized as being a revolution, certainly not by the people in America, and I don't think many foreigners have put that sort of a label on it. But if you look hard and attempt to examine what we've done south of your border, I think you must admit in the end, as I do, that we, if it isn't a revolution, it certainly is a vital reordering of our priorities and our understanding of ourselves and indeed of our institutions. To my way of thinking, this process began precisely 20 years ago with a famous decision of the United States Supreme Court, which was called Brown versus the Board of Education, a decision in which the Supreme Court ruled that educational facilities must be equal for all persons, regardless of their race or any other conditions. And this decision, which was sweeping in its effects and seemed at first largely to apply to institutions of the South, set in motion the civil rights movement in the United States, which was designed to bring into reality those rights which were placed in the Constitution, in the Bill of Rights and the various amendments to the Constitution, guaranteeing all citizens of the United States equality in all their various relationships. A noble declaration, but one which had not at that time been uniformly applied, and particularly not to persons to blacks and other minorities, and one which, to be sure, even today is not applied uniformly in the United States, but one which in the past 20 years has made notable progress. We sometimes think in the United States that the long struggle to try to achieve genuine equality among citizens is almost a hopeless struggle. We fight and fight for it, and we take two steps forward and slip back one. And yet, I submit that anyone looking at the situation in America or in the United States today, as compared with 20 years ago, is bound to be struck by the remarkable steps forward which have been taken in ensuring that citizens do receive equal treatment, not only in the field of education, but in the field of voting rights, in the field of all the different kinds of access to government and relationships which affect the ordinary human being. It's far from perfect, and it has not been a struggle which has been carried through without intense conflict, dividing the country, dividing people against each other, a conflict which has caused bloodshed and uprisings and political convolutions, many of which are still in effect. Not all of the results certainly have been positive, but on balance, enormous progress has been made in what I think is probably the most difficult of all human relationships. In the years that I have spent as a foreign correspondent, particularly in the communist countries, which always profess that they have actual equality of relations among sexes and races and things of that kind, I must confess I have never seen anything to equal what's going on in the United States. In those countries and in many other countries, including those of Western Europe, you find lip service to this kind of a standard. But the truth of the matter is, none of these nations have had the diversity of races that the United States has had. None of them have had the very, very sizable minorities. In fact, in some cases, it was not a case of a minority achieving rights, but in many communities, it was a case of the majority achieving rights. And in no case that I know of has there been anything like the remarkable steps forward that have been taken by the United States to bring into reality a stated principle which had long been ignored and which people had simply turned their eyes away from. Now this struggle, which as I say is still in progress in the United States and which has caused enormous social changes and enormous social conflicts, was not by any means the only one which has marked the last two decades in the United States. It was followed shortly thereafter by a movement which was almost equally seismic in its effects, which struck the campuses of the United States, one which had as its ultimate focus the struggle against the Vietnam War, but which in many cases originated in the American campuses as a revolt of students against relationships, against educational systems, which they felt had created a situation of alienation, often between the faculty and the students, an educational system which they felt was not adequate to their needs, an educational system which perpetuated various past customs which the young people felt were not apropos in the contemporary world. This struggle was equally severe. It certainly rocked one university and one college in the United States from the Pacific to the Atlantic. There was not a single one, I think, in the whole country that did not feel its effects, and I know that many heads of universities either resigned or quit or retired. Many of them felt the system could never be the same again. And yet, if you go to those colleges and universities today, you will find that some years after this struggle had been carried through, that the revolutionary changes which were brought into the campuses have been absorbed, that the relationship between the students and the faculty has settled down to something which is more positive and more rewarding on both sides, that the universities have not been put out of business, education has not gone on the rocks. The students are studying harder, I believe, today than they have in many, many years, and the atmosphere in the universities and in the educational system in general is far better than it was before this very strong movement got underway. Now, to be sure, that was only the opening phase of the revolutionary movement which began in the American campuses, because that's touched off what amounted to one of the greatest political and social struggles that the United States has seen, surely since the days of the Great Depression of the late 20s and early 30s, and many people would rate it, I think, as next in impact to the struggle which culminated in our Civil War. It did not produce civil war in the United States, and yet at times on the campus of Kent State University or any one of the other colleges where violence erupted and we had actual armed combat between the armed forces of the National Guard or the police and students with casualties, just as in any war, it looked certainly like a revolution. And it hit every part of the country. It divided the country into factions as bitterly antagonistic to each other as I think were the factions which were involved in the Great War over slavery in the middle of the last century. And certainly, while that struggle was going forward, there was a feeling among many people, and I wouldn't be surprised if it was shared by some people in this audience and people north of our border, that the United States was simply shaking itself to pieces and that it would never be the same again, that the political system was coming apart, and there was no telling where it was going to lead the country. Well, it was a great struggle, and it certainly has left enormous marks on the United States. It's left scars on the political surface. It's ruined political careers. It drove one president out of office. Surely President Johnson was driven out of office as much as any political figure could be, by the uprising of the people against his policies and against the war, and certainly it played a very major role in the eventual undoing of President Nixon. And those are two events as traumatic as any that have occurred in American political history. And naturally, the scars are deep and the wounds are still open and raw in many places, but I think there are very few people who would not say, whether they are Americans or observers of the American scene, that in the end, the outcome of this struggle, the effect upon the American body politic, the effect of it on the citizens and on the whole process of democracy has been a positive one. And that whereas in the middle of the struggle people said they didn't think the democratic system could survive, now that we've come through that, there is a feeling that it is stronger than it has been in the past and stronger than it has been for many, many years. Now, what makes me call this movement a revolution, or at least revolutionary in its aspects, is the fact that it has struck so many different kinds of institutions in the United States. It's not merely the schools and the educational system of the country which have been affected. It's not merely the matter of equal voting rights for blacks and whites, or for many of the other minorities, the Chicanos, the Indians, all the different races that make up the country, and many of which certainly have been discriminated over the past. But it has been an examination of other institutions which one could fairly call part of the American establishment, whether they're provided for in the Constitution or not. The great movement of consumerism, which is symbolized perhaps by the name of Ralph Nader, which is in effect a severe criticism and critique of American business and commercial practices, has achieved enormous momentum, has caused great corporations for the first time to consider the actual effect upon the population of many of their policies. It's caused them to change policy, to change their attitudes, not only toward the consumer, but toward the country as a whole. And the parallel movement, which is called environmentalism, but which I think has a very close association with consumerism, the movement which is designed to bring to the attention of Americans the fact that that the life practices of Americans has had the effect to destroy the very continent which they populate, with in some cases almost irreversible effects. This also has had some of its strongest impact upon industry and business in the country, because it is often the practices of industries which contribute so materially to pollution. It's caused the whole country to take a new look at itself and the way of its life. It's caused it to take a very hard look at the automobile, and it was taking that even before the great oil crisis has compelled us to take an even harder look at the automobile and the highway and the effect it has had upon our way of life. One of the most interesting things about this has been that it has stimulated criticism and self-criticism from within. Once the rising tide of public criticism is manifest, then you find the great corporations, the businesses, the institutions which are affected, turning inward upon themselves and examining their policies to decide on whether or not they have been right over the long period of years, whether there are things which they should do and have not been doing, and how they can live and continue to exist and grow in the face of this new attitude, so far as the average American citizen is concerned. And it has not been confined by any means merely to business, although I've been concentrating on that for a moment or two. We've had a new look at our great religions, these movements having started within them in many cases. The changes which have come over, for instance, that great Roman Catholic religion started not in the United States, but strongly reverberating there, started undoubtedly by Pope John, but nowhere in the world have the consequences been so sharp and so shattering as they have been in the United States, a process that has spread to the other great faiths, all of them looking at themselves and holding up the mirror to see whether indeed they are living up to the standards which are demanded of them by the people of the latter part of this 20th century of ours. It's caused the great professions to look to themselves. The medical profession, for example, which has been subject to a kind of public criticism which it has never felt in the history of the United States. And that, in turn, has stimulated a process of self-criticism within the medical profession. The legal profession, which has gone on for a century or two, I think with hardly looking at what it was doing, hardly challenging anything, any of the habits and customs that had grown up around it, now for the first time taking a very hard look at itself, particularly in view of the very large number of members of that profession who turned out to be engaged in the most dubious kind of activities as revealed in the great Watergate investigation. Even the profession that I represent, the news profession, the newspaper and radio and television media, have been compelled to look to themselves, and I think with a great and positive effect. I didn't think very much of the criticism that was directed at us by former Vice President Agnew. He's not exactly a person whom you would pick out of a hat as the best critic of the media. And he is not so well known today as he was then, but he did make a very sharp attack on the press and the electronic media and compelled them, for whatever reason, and I think his reasons were probably political, compelled them to take a look at their procedures and their practices. He made us, as a newspaper, examine ourselves and at least raise the question as to whether or not we were indeed as objective in our treatment of the news as we like to think that we were. It caused the great American television networks to take an inward look at their practices in their news divisions, and I think that by and large this turned out to be a good and healthy thing. I think it was good and healthy because we responded to that criticism not merely by throwing up a smokescreen of defense. We certainly did defend ourselves. We certainly did criticize Mr. Agnew for things that we thought were unfair. But at the same time, we took a hard look. We sat down and we went through check by check on each one of the charges he made against us, and we tried to think of any that he had not thought of. And we came out of it with a better newspaper. And I think this was true of papers across the country, and I know it was true of the electronic news media as well. And so this confirms my general belief. I think this is what has happened in general in each one of the professions and each one of the institutions which have been attacked, that where there has been the positive response of defending yourself against absurd and unfair criticism, but along with it the healthy inward turning to see whether or not you really are as good as you thought you were, I think it's been an extremely good thing for the country. Now, as this process has moved on from one area to another, the thing which strikes me most forcefully about it is that it is a continuous, almost a rolling process. It doesn't halt at one particular point. It goes on. Many people, I think, thought that it culminated with the rising tide of criticism against the government and its policy in Vietnam, the rising tide of criticism that swept Mr. Johnson out of office and indeed put Mr. Nixon in office. And I think there would have been very few people indeed who would have predicted that it would move on from that point and begin to center more and more on the very heart and center of the American system, the White House itself. And yet, that is exactly what did happen. It moved on into Washington, and the center of the investigation, the criticism, the charges, the countercharges, more and more began to revolve around the White House itself. Now, you might say this was an accidental thing, that it was touched off by a curiously weird burglary in the Watergate complex, and that if this had not happened, there would not have been this kind of a concentration of the media and the various investigative agencies of the United States on the White House and its practices. I happen to think that that certainly was. It was an accidental circumstance that set it off, but I also believe that two things probably made it inevitable that the White House itself would become the center of inquiry, the center of conflict, the center of a rising firestorm of criticism from the American people. One was the atmosphere which was already rising in the country, an atmosphere of criticism, an atmosphere of alienation from institutions, a general feeling out there among the public at large that there was something basically wrong with the country. and they had already demonstrated to their own satisfaction that this did exist in the challenges to institutions which had already occurred. It had been demonstrated in the case of the Vietnam War, and particularly with the publication of the Pentagon Papers, that the deep-seated suspicion that existed among people that they were not being told the truth by Washington was indeed a fact. They were not being told the truth. The truth was being concealed from them. And once they had that confirmation, their feeling that there was more rottenness in Washington and more things wrong with the system became stronger and stronger. And since, in fact, it was a suspicion which was amply confirmed by what was actually going on behind the secret walls of the White House, and since there were so many things going wrong, I am confident that even if that watchman on that particular night hadn't noticed the tape on a particular door that kept it from locking and reported this suspicious circumstance to the police, that something else would have gone wrong, something else equally trivial, would have come to the surface, and the whole great Watergate thing would have begun to unravel. I don't know what that might have been, but I'm sure it would have happened. In any event, that little telltale piece of tape did lead to the great Watergate inquiry. And I think that it's important there to notice how accidental the whole thing was and how it began from this little circumstance that it seemed for a period of time to be a trivial political trick confined to some underlings, a case so unimportant that a few police reporters in Washington were the only ones assigned to it. And then that gradually, without anyone quite knowing what they were getting into, the thing began to grow and the suspicions began to spread, and they spread and they spread, and as they spread, more and more attention was given to it, and the newspapers and the media began to devote a great time and effort to uncovering what was happening or what had happened within the Nixon administration. And then, and I think it's important to establish this, too, that it was not merely the newspapers, and in fact, in many respects, it wasn't the newspapers which provided the main impetus for that great inquiry. It was the normal channels of government itself, the courts and the legal agencies, and particularly that remarkable judge, Judge Sirica in Washington, who, by simply going ahead and carrying out his ordinary judicial duties, and the prosecutors and all the rest of them carrying out their normal judicial duties, and then Congress being brought into it, and Senator Irwin and all the rest of it, were able to develop what actually had been happening. And as that thing moved along, it became, of course, irresistible and irreversible, with the result that for the first time in American history, a president actually was compelled to resign from the White House or face the possibility that he would be, not the possibility, the inevitability that he would be impeached, and the extreme probability that he would be convicted and forced out of office, thus being the first in American history to suffer that particular fate. Now, we have not yet come to the end of the trail of Watergate, although we seem to have most of the evidence in there. But one never knows. There's so many strange bits and pieces that are flapping around in the breeze that maybe one of these trails will lead to further connections. One does not know. Certainly, I think that most people would have predicted, and I would have been among them, that after the Watergate, after President Nixon was driven out of office, that the American people really had reached the culmination of this unprecedented self-examination. I might say that it strikes me very forcefully, perhaps, this process of self-examination, because having lived and worked as a newspaper man so much in the communist countries of the world where they pride themselves on criticism and self-criticism, but really never criticize anybody who has any real power, I'm enormously proud to see this thing going forward in my own country. I don't think that any nation has really gone through this sort of process that we have in the United States in the last 20 years of taking one pillar of the establishment after the other and holding it up to an X-ray eye and and judging it on the basis of whether or not it's really functioning according to those principles which we all, it turns out, really believe in. I know that as I've been to Europe in the years since this process has been going on, again and again, I've been confronted with skeptical questions, particularly in countries like Italy or France, about why are you so upset about wiretapping? Why are you so upset about officials who turn out to be corrupt? Isn't that the normal kind of government? And they do not realize that that somehow or other there is still this old-fashioned feeling in the United States that government should not be corrupt. I know that my communist friends are particularly disturbed by this. They cannot quite understand why Americans are upset when they discover that there are many crooks in public office. Of course, they have operated on the theory that all capitalists are crooks, and so what's new about what's happened in the United States? But when their dear friend Mr. Nixon finally did lose the presidency, they were hard put in Moscow to find some explanation of how this could come about, because up to the very bitter end, they had refused to recognize that there was anything wrong with him. They've now come up with an explanation, which I don't think is very satisfactory to their public, and I don't believe is believed by their leaders. They have decided that it's all a row between two different capitalist gangs, and one of them made up some charges against the other, and they threw Nixon out, Nixon being the representative of the Western capitalists. And the Eastern capitalists have come out on top in the person of Jerry Ford and Mr. Rockefeller. I don't think this is an explanation which is likely to carry much weight, even among the public in Moscow. But it is difficult, I think, for people who have become extraordinarily cynical, and I think many Americans have been very cynical about their government and their way of life, to suddenly realize that the basic opinion in the country stands for the principles, those remarkable principles that were written into the Constitution almost 200 years ago. I know there were many Americans who felt that we were coming up to our 200th anniversary and there wasn't anything very much to celebrate. In fact, many of them were coming up to the 200th anniversary and looking at the event with a good deal of horror, because they had a feeling that somewhere along the line, the great thrust of that extraordinary document of the Constitution had been lost, that what with the new technological world, with the rise of the superpowers, with the enormous bureaucracy in Washington, and the general alienation of the public from all of its institutions, that the 200th anniversary of the founding of the Republic was going to be more like a wake than a celebration. Well, it may be. It's coming up next year, and it may be that we won't find much to celebrate, but I have a feeling that if we look back on what has been happening in the United States for the last two decades and what is still going on, that we will find something to celebrate. And I might say that the process is still in motion, somewhat to my surprise, and I really don't know where it's going to end, because beginning in December, thanks in part at least to the activities of an indefatigable New York Times correspondent in Washington, who had been spent some years in delving into the matter, we are now engaged in a national inquiry into the CIA, the FBI, and the dozens of domestic intelligence agencies which seem to have grown up over the years, whose activities are so complex and so intertwined in almost all branches of American life that even persons like myself who've long observed them from afar begin to be astounded when it turns out that the CIA actually has been in partnership with the mafia for many, many years, engaging in various kinds of activities jointly beneficial to each. If they're engaged with the mafia, and now it turns out that the CIA had a very close relationship with Howard Hughes, one begins, the mind begins to boggle, and all those terrible paranoid conspiratorial theories of assassinations and things that I've been resolutely putting aside for many years come back to haunt me. I still don't think that there's any basis for them, but who knows what next will be unturned. We have 3 major investigations of the CIA now underway, one under Governor Rockefeller, one by the United States Senate, one by the House of Representatives, and each day brings new evidence of things that bear looking into. I simply must say that the end is not in sight yet. I don't think now, looking at what has been gone into in the last 20 years, I don't think that the CIA intelligence police agency inquiry is going to be the last of these processes. Along the line, the Congress itself has been investigated, and it probably will be investigated considerably more, although it has taken enormous steps to clean itself up and set firmer rules concerning its relationship to the large corporations and other people who provide sums for the financing of campaigns. The judicial branch has certainly taken a look at itself. I think that there's going to be more attention paid to the media, to the newspapers, and the great electronic news agencies. Many people are very critical of them. Some of these people are persons who don't like the role that the media have been playing in serving as an investigative arm of the people. It's all right to investigate your opponent, but they don't like it when their own spokesman is investigated. And as things are going now, almost everyone manages to get investigated in one way or another in the United States. One of the newest wrinkles that is now possible, we are told, thanks to our new Freedom of Information Act, which makes it possible to dig out of the government files all kinds of information, is that anybody in the country who wants to write in to the CIA or the FBI and get their record from those secret files can get it. I can just imagine some 200 million Americans writing in and saying, please send me what you've got on me, no knowing where that process may end. I think I'll write in and find out what they've got on me. They probably have a lot, considering the fact that I've spent so much time in communist countries. This process that I've been describing to you is certainly not like the revolution that we have in our minds when we use that word. We think of a revolution as being a military uprising, a coup d'etat, or something like happened in Petrograd in 1917, or in Paris at the time of the storming of the Bastille, or possibly something like happened in China during those long years when Mao was fighting his way to power and to establishing the regime of the People's Republic in that great country. Certainly that isn't characteristic of the American Revolution, if indeed it is a revolution, though there has been fighting enough and casualties enough if one were to add them all up. But what has happened has been fundamental changes in institutions. And since institutions are really what govern a country, it seems to me that during these years we have been creating what amounts to a revolution in the United States. But it's a curious kind of revolution in that its goal seems to be not to move on to something new by way of a system, but to try and get the system back to what it was when it was created. That is to say, to get it back to the principles which motivated the creators. Naturally, 200 years after 1776, we have a different country. We're not a small colonial agrarian country existing on a distant hemisphere with very few ties to the world. We are the most powerful country in the world with ties to every country, interconnections to the effect so complete and so complex that any little event in the United States is apt to have repercussions in almost every country in the world. We ourselves have become so technological that we sometimes find it difficult to recognize the country for the technology. But nonetheless, it turns out that there is in the land a spirit of survival, a spirit of dedication to those great principles on which the Democratic Republic was founded. And I would say that what we're trying to do is to create a United States which is consistent with the kind of world in which we live today, that is to say, a global world filled with global threats and global relationships, a world which is based on technology, a world which recognizes its resources as being finite, whether they are material or human, that we are trying to fit the country which lives under these conditions into the principles on which it was founded. Now, we may not succeed in that process. It's a most ambitious kind of thing. And as I say, I don't think there's any single person in the country who's aware that this is really what we're trying to do. When you talk to Americans, as I'm talking to you this evening, they usually seem surprised that that's what we've been doing in the past 20 years. And I may be mistaken. Maybe we're not doing that. But if you add it all up, it seems to me that's the pattern that lies behind it. And if we continue as successfully in the future as we have thus far, I think that it's going to create the basis for a United States which will not only be a much better place to live in, a much better place for its own people, a land which is more equitable, a land which is less harsh, less forbidding, a land which is less destructive of itself and its own resources, but a better country to the world in general, a better neighbor for you here in Canada, a better country so far as the rest of the world is concerned, because it will be a country which knows where it's at and has some notion of where it's going and has a certain set of principles to guide itself by. And that, I think, is what we had lost during that long, long period in which we were sort of on a Rip Van Winkle sleep. We were not paying attention to where we were going. We were not paying attention to what had happened to our institutions, be they in Washington or be they in the smallest community of the country. It isn't going to solve our problems. It isn't going to eliminate the criminality which we have. It isn't going to eliminate the drug problem. It's not going to eliminate the urban blight that covers the country from one end to the other, but it's going to give us a base and a position, I think, from which we can attack those great problems. And those are the things which we must concern ourselves with. Those are the problems which we share with many, many other countries, and which, if they are not solved, may be the eventual ruination of the world. The world can be ruined in many ways. It can be ruined in a twinkle by nuclear war, but it also can be destroyed in a century of destruction of the environment. And if the Americans can get their own affairs into order, and I suspect that they are moving in that direction, they will be much more able as well as capable of tackling these great problems, not only in their own land, but in the other lands of the world. And that, I think, is what's been happening in the United States, and that's what I hope has been happening, and that's the message I bring you here tonight. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Mr. Salisbury says that he will answer any questions from the audience as usual.
Yes, sir.
Will you repeat?
Do you mind if I come down and use the mic?
Well, yeah, I know.
Just ask a question, all right?
Basically, Mr. Salisbury, what you outlined with the Watergate situation was the fact that through two police reporters who got messages from an informant in the White House came the entire Watergate scandal. Now, if you look at Watergate, you have a situation in which
Daniel... Excuse me. To the question, please.
Excuse me, I didn't say that. I said that these two reporters started out on the investigation and that it gradually picked up steam and many other people moved in on it. I also said, as you probably recall, I believe that the corruption was so widespread that something else would have started the process on. I don't think it was dependent on this single accident of the porter and the tape and the two reporters. I think that one way or another, the atmosphere in the country was such and the corruption in the White House was such that the investigation and the revelation of what was going on would have occurred.
Yeah, well, basically, first of all, my name's Alan Levinson. I'm the candidate for mayor of Surrey on the North American Labor Party.
Now, excuse me, but we
basically,
can't pick up this.
Yeah,
okay.
Basically,
we'll just go on.
Basically, the Initiatives Committee for New Economic Policies has just been formed in the U.S. With Leonard Woodcock, the head of the United Auto Workers, Robert Roosa, I'm sure you're familiar with him.
I know him very well.
Yes. Now, they've explicitly called for fascism.
Oh,
now,
no, I don't know about that.
Here, I'll show you an article
Pardon me, but we'll have to. Sorry.
Would you like to?
We'll take the next question.
Let me have the article. I'll take it with me.
Here, I'll show you.
Dr. Vogt, just leave one, and then we'll.
Thanks.
Here's
here,
another
it's
question.
In the centerfold.
Okay.
You might take a look
take
at it.
I will.
What do you think about that? I'm asking you a question. What do you think about
Dr.
them
Vogt.
Calling for fascism?
You just
don't recognize it. I'm asking one question. A distinguished ancestor of yours was once told by an angry young Tory that all the world's evil stems from two sources, Christianity and journalism. And your distinguished ancestor questioned Christianity, of course, but why journalism? My question to you is, who is that distinguished ancestor of yours that was he right?
Well, my question to you is, who was that ancestor of mine? I never heard of him. Well, I have no relationship to that family whose family name is Cecil, to the best of my recollection. I'm sorry.
Dr. Vogt.
Is journalism on the same par as a politician? Is Salzberger as good a man as Richard Nixon?
No.
Dr. Vogt.
Mr. Salisbury, you described how in all these changes take place in the United States, the press, I think, has played an important role. But looking at the United States from Canada, one sometimes had the impression that with a few notable exceptions, the press hasn't led the changes at looking at the world outside. For instance, there was a fiction maintained largely
American newspapers. Certain American newspapers have always paid a great deal of attention to these questions, and I think have played a leading role in the Cuban question, the China question. Many other papers have not. They simply have ignored the world in general. But to come to the defense of the best American newspapers, I would say that there are in the United States a dozen papers, at any rate, which have been leaders in most of these cases in trying to bring to the people a reasonable account of the reality of the world. So far as China is concerned, as you probably will recall, but maybe many in the audience here does not know, after the Chinese Communists came into power, and a period had followed in which the United States, unfortunately, was engaged in in outright war with China during the Korean affair when the Chinese intervened and we were fighting the Chinese. After the Korean fighting died down, American newspapers were very eager to go to China and report what was going on there. And a group of them, some 20 or 22 American correspondents, were invited by Zhou Enlai to come to China. And the correspondents were ready to go. And Mr. Dulles, the Secretary of State, refused to give them visas to go to China. The American newspapers in general fought this decision as hard as they could, and within about a year were able to get it overturned and got permission to send their reporters to China. Unfortunately, by that time, the Chinese had changed their mind, as they had every right to do, and they now refused to let those reporters come to China. So that I would say, in that particular respect, the press had done as much as it was able to do at that particular period of time, and were thwarted by the adamant policies of Mr. Dulles. Now, so far as Cuba is concerned, the relationship of the United States with Cuba, of course, has been a rather hysterical affair for a good many years. I would have to be fair, however, to say that in recent years, and curiously enough, this is true under the Nixon administration, there has been really no heat at all on the Cuban issue from any area. Many American correspondents have gone to Cuba and reported on what was going on there, and to their amazement found that the American public was really not particularly interested in it, nor was the administration. At the moment, it looks very much as though the administration is going forward and will, within the next few months, establish normal relations with Cuba, or it may take a little longer than that, but they certainly are moving very strongly in that direction. I think it will occur, however, within a year, and that the ripples will be practically unnoticeable as far as the United States is concerned.
Yes.
Could you hear that?
Yes. She was surprised at the... yes. There was a question about not mentioning Jack Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy as one of the, a couple of the terrible things that had happened during that era. They just commented on your lack of commentary.
Was the thrust of the question that that I failed to mention the assassination of the two men as part of the traumatic experience of the United States? If so, I didn't mention that, nor did I mention the assassination of some other people, Martin Luther King and others, because it didn't seem to me that these fit the pattern of the kind of things I was talking about, which have been popular movements within the United States directed at one objective or another, at a particular political, economic, or social goal. Now, if I were to put those events in context, I would say that in general, although the assassinations, each one of them has an individual author, and to my view, they are not connected in any way, nonetheless, they are perhaps a byproduct of the general turbulence in the United States created by this very traumatic process that we've been going through. So you might say that these men and a number of others have been victims of the struggle which has accompanied this remarkable movement for social change in the country. The question has to do with whether the pictures of violence on television have something to do with the increase in violence in the country. This may be true, and I know that many, many people believe it to be true. I myself am very dubious of this. I don't believe that violence is caused by movies or pictures or even by the dime novels I used to read as a child, which were full of murders and blood and horror. I think that fairy stories are made up of the most violent and awful things in the world, but I don't think they're responsible for the fact that violence continues to exist in the world. I doubt very much that there is a connection, but I do know that some psychologists and many people in general believe there is a linkage.
Yes, Dr.
Salisbury, may I ask whether your thesis also applies to the trade union movements in the United States?
I'm afraid I would have to say that so far as the trade union movement in the United States is concerned, that this is one of the frozen institutions which has been remarkably unsubject to revolutionary change or change of any kind during this 20-year period. We do, of course, have a few union leaders who are progressive and who attempt to carry the movement forward onto new ground. But I think if you were to take most of the big unions in the United States and their leadership, you would find the leaders are the same men who were in charge not only 20 years ago, but maybe 40 years ago, and that their policies have hardly changed during that period of time, and that in general, this is one of the most regressive
areas of political and social life in the country.
Yes, sir. When, if ever, do you think the United States will get out of Vietnam?
Question is, when, if ever, will the United States get out of Vietnam? I think it's in the process now. I think Cambodia is closing down. I think Sihanouk is coming back into power there with the Khmer Rouge. I don't think anything can stop that. I don't think the United States is going to stop it. I think that is the first act. How long it will be before we see a rather similar chain of events in South Vietnam, I don't know, but I think that also will occur sometime within the next couple of years.
Yes. If more journalists had followed the methods of Mr. Iof Stone, if there would have been any difference in the reporting of Watergate.
Follow the methods of what?
Who was it that you asked about? Iof Stone.
Oh, Iof Stone? Well, he's a great hero of mine, and I think of most American journalists. He's unique. He's sui generis. I don't think we can all be Iof Stones. I wish we could, but... part of his work is, a great deal of his work is done constantly investigating records and in the reference libraries and studying the reports of congressional committees and things of that kind, and it's extraordinarily effective. I think we need a good many IF Stones, but I don't think we all should be IF Stones. I think that many journalists in the United States, perhaps 20 years ago, were inclined to write off Iof Stone and think that he was... he was sort of a nut, sort of a crank, who worried himself about questions that we didn't have time to bother with. That attitude has changed entirely. He's a hero, and he's constantly being honored. And the other day, he got a degree from his university. I think it was Michigan, Pennsylvania, where he'd never gotten a degree when he was in college because he didn't have time to finish his course.
Yes, sir.
In the what?
The pardoning of Nixon.
Question is, if the American system was at its best in Watergate, wasn't it at its worst in the pardoning of Nixon? No, I don't think that's its worst. I think that was a bad chapter. I don't think Nixon should have been pardoned, but I don't think that was the worst by any means. I think that just to take one little thing, I think the wiretapping under Nixon was far worse than the pardon of Nixon. From the standpoint of the relationship of the people to Mr. Nixon, he was indeed punished. The verdict of the people was absolutely clear so far as he was concerned. The fact that he was pardoned for crimes and things which we didn't even know whether he had committed or not didn't really change that verdict. And I don't think it will change history's verdict either.
Yes, sir.
I'd like to know your views on the laws which require reporters to give the source of their information to court. And is the beneficial role of the media in investigating the government causing the re-examination of the legal position of the press?
How do you feel about the press having to reveal the sources of their, and whether this is going to cause a similar...
This question is a very critical one, because it relates to the ability of the press to maintain the security of its transactions. That is to say, its ability to guarantee someone who talks to the reporter that the source will not be revealed under pressure of any kind. There has been in very recent years, and stimulated quite clearly by the Nixon administration, but not in, This is not just part of the Nixon administration. There has been a growing movement in the United States to compel reporters under subpoena by grand juries to submit their notebooks, their photographs, their files, and their testimony has been demanded in criminal cases. It involves a very tricky question because many people believe that if a reporter, for example, were to learn in confidence about who committed the murder, that he has a duty as a citizen to report this fact to the authorities. I'm taking an extreme example because it's the extreme examples which make for the difficult cases. And reporters are troubled about it too because they believe that there may be conflicts of interest here. But actually, the thrust of these cases and the thrust of the judicial interference with what we regard as the basic freedoms of the press doesn't concern that kind of extreme cases. It almost always concerns an investigation of some controversial matter. A reporter, for example, will report that the local politicians have been in on the graft in some case. And then the reporter will be summoned before a grand jury, and there will be a demand that he reveal the source of that information. Now, if a reporter can be compelled to reveal that kind of information, obviously nobody's going to come and give him that kind of information. So the reporters and the editors refuse, and in certain cases, and there have been half a dozen in the last two or three years, they've gone to jail for contempt of court for a refusal to cooperate in this kind of investigation. Now, this has touched off in the United States a movement for what they call a shield law. And these laws have indeed been passed by many states which protect a reporter from being compelled to give this kind of information in investigating to investigating agencies and grand juries. And there's been a great deal of talk about the possibility of having a national shield law which would exempt reporters and editors entirely from being compelled to give this sort of information. I might say that in my own profession, there's a lot of disagreement over whether or not this kind of a law is a good thing. What many of us, including myself, worry about is that if a law is passed, that it will then set a particular guideline, and the exceptions will then be worked upon. Often when you approve a law that's designed to protect, the lawyers go to work and they find a lot of exemptions that aren't covered by that law. And you might find yourself in a worse situation than you are today. My own feeling is that the profession itself and the newspapers and the media are probably better off without that kind of protection, that they must protect themselves, they must be prepared to go to jail if necessary, as reporters now do, in order to protect that, the security of information that is confidential of that nature. I don't regard this, frankly, as a major threat against the press. It might have been had the Nixon administration stayed in, because they were clearly one of the instigators of it, and it was one of a number of weapons in an arsenal which they had directed against the media.
Preparing the public or the profession?
Preparing the students.
The students.
For the kind of...
For this kind of thing.
And if you don't think they're doing it, then advice would you give them?
Question has to do with whether the educational establishment is preparing students to cope with the kind of issues that I've been talking about, and if not, what they should do. That is a complex question to answer because many educational institutions are indeed preparing students to cope with this sort of thing. I was talking with a college student only two or three nights ago who was telling me about in the particular school that he goes to that the young faculty members there seem to spend most of their time turning the students on to this kind of a problem and arousing them to be on the alert against challenges to their basic rights, which I think is a fine thing. although perhaps if they devote all their time to that, there wouldn't be much time for anything else. I don't really think it's so much an educational question. I think basically the educational system works pretty well, although like any educational system, it's good, bad, and indifferent. Some places it works better and some places less. I think that the role of the education of the citizen is one which newspapers and media themselves carry out, perhaps more generally than the educational system. After all, we're the ones who bring the news and the State of the Union to the people. And it's part of our duty, certainly, to keep people on the alert to the kind of things that are going on. And I think that we've been doing this job much better in recent times than we were prior to this. And we must go on and do it better in the future. I also think that it is an obligation and a necessity for students and citizens of a country, particularly I'm speaking of my own country, to inform themselves and not simply to sit back and take anything that is ladled out to them. I'm convinced that the resources for finding out what's happening in general in the country are available to any alert citizen, anyone who's interested. He certainly has a remarkable number of newspapers and magazines and electronic facilities, libraries, educational institutions, things of that kind. When I compare this with those available in any other country that I know of, it seems impossible to believe that an ordinarily alert American citizen in an ordinary community can't be pretty well briefed on what's happening in his own country or almost any place in the world. But he has to want to do that, and this, I think, is something which we must stimulate him to do.
Yes.
You mentioned Agnew's criticism of the lack of objectivity in the news media. Here's a question I would like to ask you. What role do you think style plays in the reporting of news in newspapers and in the reporting of news on television?
What role does style? Well, I think it plays an important role, though I don't think that it plays I don't think it plays the most important role by any means. I think it certainly is an aid to understanding, an aid to comprehension, let's say, an aid to people being interested in what's going on. But it doesn't seem to me that it's one of those major characteristics that one has to worry about.
Yes, sir. Mr. Alfred, we have had a ringside seat on the events which you describe as the kind of revolution going on in your country. But what of the cloning of Sir Basil Zaharov, as described in a Henry Luce journal recently, armaments for everybody? Does this total immersion in the tools of death, selling them all over the world, does this not refute the reality of your revolution?
A very good question, and certainly it's come to my own mind a good deal lately when I see that the United States is selling more arms abroad in a given year than it's providing to its own defense forces. I think that's a slight reversal of priority. But this is one of the things that we're going to get in hand, quite clearly. This is something this is one of the many kind of things that have been growing up in the United States, and I think that we're going to see an end of that kind of thing or at least a very sharp curtailment of it very, 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 very soon. I must say that I'm delighted with that question because I happened to be getting out of the university at the time when Zaharov was the great criminal in the world because he was selling maybe $5 million worth of arms from Switzerland to various countries. And he was a merchant of death, and it was a great headline in the newspapers and a great Senate investigation in the United States. Well, $5 million wouldn't buy a wing off some of those planes that we sell in lots by the dozen to the Arab countries.
Should I take two more?
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
You spoke about how the average American citizen will have access to information about public events. In that case, I'm wondering how you possibly excuse any of the United States senators and congressmen who were out there in the Vietnam War and didn't speak out against it.
He wants to know how you excuse the senators who were close to the business with the Vietnam War for not speaking out. at the time. Yes.
How I excuse him? If your question is how I excuse the senators who knew what was happening in Vietnam for not speaking out against it, I don't excuse them. Why should I? Americans generally don't excuse them. That's why so many of them aren't in office anymore.
One more question. Yes, Dr. Cates.
What, Mr. Salisbury, care to comment on...
That's all right. Go ahead, Orson.
Would you care to comment on the situation in the Near East, apart from Dr. Kissinger
thing? Question has to do with the situation in the Near East and the role of Dr. Kissinger there. I don't happen to be one of those, and there are many who believe that we're on the verge of war in the Middle East. There have been many, many predictions there's going to be a war again in this spring or at the latest in the fall. I don't think that's true. I think that Dr. Kissinger is working very, very hard to achieve the beginning of a negotiation, and if not a settlement, between Egypt and Israel. I think he's achieved a certain amount of progress there. I think that both he and Mr. Gromyko, both Washington and Moscow, do not want war to break out again in the Middle East. They may have slightly different ideas of how it should be prevented. Dr. Kissinger likes to take a central role in things and bring it off himself. I think he's terribly eager to do this because his prestige has been badly damaged in the United States and internationally, and he badly needs a great triumph, and this would give him one. It might enable him then to leave office with kudos rather than with complaints. I think that both countries are serious about keeping the peace in the Middle East, and I think as long as that's true, that we have a good chance of escaping war there. I don't think that by any means Dr. Kissinger or anyone, even if he were 100 times as much of a genius as Dr. Kissinger thinks he is, could actually bring peace, a guarantee of peace in the Middle East in a few months. This is something that's going to have to be built step by step and painfully, but I think the first steps can be taken, and I wouldn't be surprised to see them taken in coming weeks. Thank you very much.
I'd like to call on the Chancellor to please thank our speaker this evening, Chancellor Nemetz.
Madam Chairman and members of the Institute and the other guests, I think that this being your last evening here, you'll pardon me if I take advantage of my position as Chancellor to move a vote of thanks to you and your executive for the fine job that you've done this year. You know, Madam Chancellor, Madam Chairman. Well, we have had one woman chancellor, and this is not the... My term of office obviously is expiring. And I won't have the pleasure as I had this year to attend the various meetings. And I want to tell you that I have spoken to my colleagues on the Board of Governors, and despite some of the suggestions from Victoria that the university sometimes doesn't consider the importance of the nexus between the university and the community, I think that you will agree that 60 years is a pretty long time and substantial proof that the originators of this university did play a great deal and pay a great deal of attention to the connection of the community, town and gown, and that this institute, which is supported by the university, is one of the best examples in public education that we still have in this city. Now, I had the pleasure of speaking to Mr. Salisbury last night about it, and we were reminiscing as both Prairie boys, he comes from Minnesota and I came from Saskatchewan originally, of how the old Chautauqua days produced education for the people. And I mentioned the history of this institute, and he said to me something that I thought I should repeat to you because it is highly complimentary to you. He said that I told him of the numbers of people that have attended this institute, especially in the last few years, and he said that was a fine commentary on the intellectuality of the Vancouver community, and I agree with him. Now, first, my duty tonight is to thank the publisher of The Sun, who an old classmate of mine, and I should tell you that all of us have frustrations. I myself was on the UBC, the student newspaper, with him, and perhaps I've had a frustration to be a journalist as I watched him climb to be publisher of The Sun. And tonight, as I heard Mr. Salisbury speak, and knowing that Mr. Keat, of course, is one of the greatest supporters of the New York Times, I felt that he must have a frustration too. You see, although he supports and he extols and actually brings Mr. Salisbury here, Mr. Salisbury's article and his colleagues appear in that other paper. But I should like, on behalf of the university, to thank Mr. Keat and to the editor, Mr. Larson, and the other members of the staff of The Sun for their generosity in supporting the Vancouver Institute on other occasions when they have brought distinguished speakers. And in particular, when they tonight have brought what I may, if Mr. Salisbury will excuse me, call the liberal face, a liberal Democrat with a small D. That type of liberal Democrat to which I think most Canadians have attuned themselves over the years and have thought best in the United States, from Franklin Roosevelt to Adlai Stevenson to Jack Kennedy. And it's that type of American, I think, that still shows us and proves to us by his speech this evening of what close ties we have to all those things which are good in the United States. And for that very fine talk he gave tonight, I wish to thank him on your behalf.